This is the Kestrel Country Podcast, where we discuss the people, places, and events all around Kestrel Country. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Kestrel Country Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Church, joined here once again by my lovely wife and co-host, Catherine.
Hello, hello.
And we are coming at you this July week. It's finally getting hot around here in Moscow. So I hope everybody's having a good summer.
Roasty toasty.
That's right. It's getting hot. So it finally feels like summer. Kids are in swimming lessons, the Herc.
Yep.
We've got a little family vacation coming up to Michigan. Looking forward to that.
There will be probably a little bit of a lull in the podcasting.
I don't know. We'll see. Maybe we'll have to do like a cherry festival, Michigan style.
Cherry Republic in Michigan is top of the list for the kids right now.
Yeah, for sure. So this week, have a fun interview with a soil scientist.
Isaac Madsen.
Not a dirt doctor.
No.
He explains how dirt and soil are different.
Yep.
And serious soil people can take offense when you call it dirt. So
I think Betsy Becker might have brought something up like that on hers too. You call it soil, or at least we were chatting about that.
Pretty interesting. So it was fascinating. Really, I mean, I could have talked for hours. We're definitely going to have Isaac back. He is he does have his doctorate and works over at Wazoo. So we talked a lot about local agriculture, local soils, some of the work he's done, different crop rotations. We talked about a lot of different things and touched a little bit on their upcoming move to Zambia.
Wow.
So definitely going to, again, have to have him back on and continue talking about local agriculture. It's always fascinating, especially this time of year with bright canola fields and the wheat starting to turn and all of that. So let's get right into the interview with Isaac Madsen. Isaac Madsen, thanks for coming in. Yeah, thanks for stopping by. We're going to talk about dirt today.
Yes, yeah. Or soil. If there's a lot of soil scientists that
get offended. They don't like it?
Yeah, they get offended when you say dirt. Technically, they're different.
They are. Yeah. Okay, well, now you got to tell us. How are they different?
So, and I'm going to mess up the official. I'll have to probably give back my soils card after this, but basically dirt would be sort of what you track into the house, you know, so it would be what makes things a mess. And then soil would be it's out in the field or out in your garden. And it has also to do with the structure and how it's working. So it has to have a biological component. So there has to be something living in it. That's been sort of debated in recent years.
Okay. If you look,
the definition of soils has actually changed as people have wanted there to be soil on Mars and wanted to go visit Mars. So now it's like, can it support life? And then soil has a structure. So it's really different than dirt in that that's a physical characteristic. So dirt could just be like a whole bunch of loose particles, essentially, and soil is going to have a structure. And so
there you go. So you are a soil scientist?
Yes.
Accurate.
Yeah, my PhD is in soil science. My job is as agronomist, and I really consider myself agronomist, but soil science is my training.
So. Okay. Well, why don't you start with just giving us a little bit of background? How did you get into that? What have you been in that? Have you been in farming your whole life? Where did you grow up?
So I grew up in Portland, Oregon.
Okay.
In the city, in Northeast Portland, right by Mall 205. Basically, tiny patio garden is all we had. Kind of interesting neighborhood. We had, I think, three times cars were stolen when I was a kid out in front of our house. So,
and it's probably gotten a lot worse since.
Yes. My parents' church is still in that neighborhood.
Okay.
And yeah, it's rough, which is always sad to see. So we moved across the river to Southwest Washington when I was sort of high school aged and was trying to figure out what to do. And decided that I wanted to do something that would allow me to sort of work and travel in other parts of, maybe you could say developing countries. I don't know what the correct phrase is, but, you know, so Bolivia was my big interest at that point.
Oh, wow.
And kind of looked at medicine, looked at engineering. And the ironic thing is I decided I didn't like, well, I knew I didn't like math, and I decided I didn't want to be in school for a long time. So I was like, oh, I don't want to do that. So I was like, well, agriculture, it's another technical field. And my dad grew up in a farming community, La Grande, Oregon. And so he encouraged me to try it. So I started taking classes and started really enjoying it for what it was, a community college. Transferred out to WSU, did WSU Vancouver for 1 year. Came out to Pullman in 2009, I believe. Fall of 09. And then basically started working in a lab as a research assistant at that point. And through that relationship, got basically recruited to do my PhD in the same lab, doing research on actually how roots grow in relation to fertilizer. So that was what my PhD was on. And yeah, stuck around WSU. I've always intended to leave. And here we are in 2022. And every time something's come up, we've just been like, oh, this is great. And I love the Palouse. And so it's
yeah,
a hard place to be.
So is it mostly wheat that you've been dealing with at Wazoo?
No, so I'm the extension agronomist for oil seeds. So
okay.
Yeah. So my specialty is sort of canola, but I've also worked with sunflower and flax, a little bit with camelina, pennycress, which is a weed right now, but they're trying to make into a biofuels crop.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I'm thinking there's other ones I've worked with. Those are the sort of the oil seeds. And then I've worked with, because we're on the Palouse, you work with wheat some. So spring wheat, winter wheat,
yeah,
barley, oats, everything. So
is that, are you partially responsible for all the yellow, all the beautiful yellow fields?
No, that would be claiming way too much. I was part of I've been part of the team for a long time that was working to promote that.
That's cool.
Yeah. So that project dates back, I think I'm going to get the history wrong, but it's like 2005, 2007, with sort of bioenergy as the initial interest. And then canola also can be a food crop. And so that was, and really from an agronomy perspective, it was solving some of our problems. So how can we diversify our crop rotation and really look at controlling some of the grass weeds? So Italian ryegrass is a big issue around here in wheat fields. And if you're growing wheat, it's very hard to control the Italian rye. It just kind of gets bigger and bigger and bigger and worse. So
is that one of the big reasons why we're seeing more of it? It's just they're rotating it in to that wheat rotation and helping out a little bit. And then wasn't there a big refinery just built recently by Tri-Cities, something like that?
It's not Tri-Cities, and I'm going to forget the name now. It's
further out.
Warden. I think it's in Warden. North.
Yeah.
North of Tri-Cities. Oh, Warden. Yeah. And so that was actually built a long time ago and then changed ownership a few times and the price wasn't stable. And so the first time that farmers were growing canola around here, the price was really bad or non-existent. Mm. And so that's why a few people tried it and then it didn't really work out. And eventually what happened is Viterra, which is a Canadian company, bought that. They have a lot of other canola facilities. And so they just bought it and started trying to pull more canola from this area. And so we've seen sort of a steady increase since Viterra bought that. So having a stable market, as an agronomist, I always like to think about solving the problems in the field. But without the market and supply chain, you can't sell your crop. And so it's like, we can grow so many more crops here than we actually grow. And we really, it's like, can you have that market and supply chain? Same thing with Shepherd's Grain. When I worked there, can the farmers can grow a ton of different things out here. It's like, can we actually, do we have a supply chain and a market for it? Which always hurts me as an agronomist, because I always want to think we can solve the problem.
Like idealistically thinking that way.
Yeah.
So what would it be the definition of agronomy?
Oh man. See, now
you're maybe not definition, but you say you're an agronomist. What is that versus?
It's everything about growing the crops out in the field.
Okay.
So it's everything from, planting density, the varieties you're going to use, the pest problems you're encountering, the fertility, which is a lot of my specialty. So how much fertilizer, when, where do you put it, things like that. That's all agronomy. And I think there's some definition that puts it together with like using a scientific approach towards that. So you're not just sort of out willy-nilly trying whatever that you're supposed to use a scientific approach.
Okay.
Towards how do we grow, how do we maximize for any given output? So how do we maximize for yield or quality or, soil health is something else we might want to maximize for. And so how do you work those into the equation.
So that's all encompassed in that. And then, like you said, separate from that is the market. What can somebody actually grow and sell? Yeah. What are the prices doing? So what you mentioned flax a minute ago. Yeah. Is that, I know one guy who, at some ground of a client of mine, they had a bunch of flax planted there a few years ago. It's gorgeous. I mean, it's like, it's flax really cool. Is,
my favorite.
Is the big holdup there the market for it?
Yeah. And I think it's also somewhat supply chain related. And I don't know the details of this. I know that sometimes trucks come from Canada and go to Portland with flax in them. And it's like, okay, we're closer, but for whatever reason, that's the way it goes. So yeah. I'm not exactly sure what the hang up is there, but we would love, I think it'd be great in a rotation to have more flax around, and it's beautiful. You think canola is pretty and then you see flax, you're like, oh, that's the really beautiful
that's awesome
plant there.
Is that, does Wazoo, cause you're working for Wazoo.
Yes.
Right.
Yep.
Is that something that they get involved with trying to, whether it's working directly with growers to educate them on that kind of thing, or are there ways that they help? Like what, besides research and teaching, what else is you doing on that?
Yeah. So if you look at my official job title, it's extension agronomist. So extension, which is sort of has a great history in the US, is basically you take the knowledge that the university is developing and take it out to the farmers. And so you're working with the farmers and it's extending the knowledge. So, trying to be really applied with it. So a lot of my job is, you know, actually texting farmers, calling farmers, visiting, looking at farms. Then in the winter, talking at like sort of grower meetings. So maybe you have 100 farmers, you know, and you'll do like Adams County and Lincoln County and travel around to these different areas and try and sort of talk. And I really try and listen a lot at those times too and hear, you know, what is the challenge? What do you, so, because I always have this mental map model of here's where we're stuck and here's where we could do better. And then I'm always trying to listen and say, okay, where are they stuck? And then that's really fun because you can bring that back into your research design, right? So if you're listening carefully, like, okay, this is the kind of research we want to develop. And then it's sort of this iterative process, working with the farmers, developing research, pulling the researchers in who maybe don't have the same connections with growers. And that's a super fun part of the job.
So do you, you mentioned some places further into Central Washington. So do you deal with irrigated ground as well as dry land crops?
Yeah, so not as much for me personally.
Okay.
But yeah, I do occasionally do irrigated. So there's some irrigated canola. The pennycress, which isn't really a crop yet, I think that's going to be its fit, is irrigated because it needs planted in the fall into shallow moisture, which we just don't have here. So
yeah,
I think it's got to be irrigated. I think maybe some like potato pennycress, and the pennycress would go over winter, and then sweet corn, sort of rotation. And it's one of those projects where it's like, oh, that'd be a cool project, but probably not my project.
Well, you mentioned too Shepherd's Grain.
Yeah.
And we were, Jeremy Bunch from Shepherd's Grain is going to be here. Yep. We're going to, you know, but we'll have to do that again. Yep. So tell me a little bit about what you did with them and how that fits into that whole thing.
So Shepherd's Grain, for folks who don't know what it is, sort of a grower cooperative, for maybe lack of a better word, which was a whole bunch of growers who were getting together. Oh man, I'm going to get my dates wrong too. So it's somewhere in the early 2000s or late 90s, got together and said, hey, we want to farm this way and we want to try and make extra money for farming this way. And we want to farm in a way that protects our soils. And that was no-till. And so we're going to direct market our grain. So what they did is they basically, you know, they keep track of where it's harvested from and then they direct market it to, you know, bakeries. So there's like small bakeries in Portland, Seattle, and then they have some larger customers too. But it's always fun for me to go to the west side and like try and find the bakeries where they're selling that flour and be like, hey, I know the guys that are growing your wheat.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
So they're kind of cutting out a middleman there by direct marketing.
Yep.
And then you said no-till. So what is no-till and how is that different from the rest of the
conventional
way people are doing things? Yeah.
So no-till is basically the idea that natural soils aren't disturbed. And so in our agricultural soils, we're going to try and plant without ever tilling the soil. So generally, you know, the historical process is like till get a really nice seed bed and then plant and then maybe even roll it and firm it up. And that's how you would farm. And that's how people farmed out here, you know, basically since the Europeans came to this part of the world, this till it over, you know, and the soils here were really deep and rich. And so you had no problems. You could just till that soil over and plant. And here, the big advantage of no-till is that you prevent erosion because of our hills. So our hills are so steep that if you have rain on a tilled soil, it'll create really bad real erosion. So if you actually this spring, if you were driving around when we were having all the spring rains and you looked at the fields that were tilled garbanzo fields, those ones, you could just see, and actually I could go find you one. There's some tillage that was going on later this spring out towards sort of dusty area and it ran really bad. So you can just see these little like rills developing it. And so basically that's sort of what was happening when agriculture first started off on the Palouse is the European settlers came and they're like, oh, look at this great soil. Started flipping it over with a plow. And so then yield started to decline. Fertilizers came in and were able to stave some of that off. And then this sort of most recent is no-till. And now we're kind of looking what's beyond that. So
is that when you say yields were declining, is that because do nutrients leave when you till it that way?
Yeah. So erosion, you lose nutrients. Gotcha. And you also develop things like plow pans. Yeah. There's a great, if you're into reading historical science papers, his last name is Bennett. I can't remember his first name, but he wrote Soil Erosion, a National Menace was the name of the paper in like 1920s. And they were observing this massive decline in yield. And that was from erosion all over. And he has pictures from all over the U.S. In that old black and white photos of some of the erosion. And it was pretty incredible because that was kind of, you know, you didn't have any herbicides for weed control. So you tilled for weed control and you tilled to prep your seed bed and you tilled basically to get the soil to mineralize the nitrogen that was in it a little faster. And so that all of those processes, you're just like mining and eroding the soil. So that was kind of the way things were done. And
well, and with the hills around here too, I mean, that's why this is what I've been told, right? So why we have that, like these ledges.
Oh yeah.
So like on our property, we've got, you know, at the bottom of the hill where it's actually now where we have our garden, it's like comes up to just this big old ledge and drops off. And what I was told is like, they would always till downhill.
Yeah.
Cause especially early our property was actually the last farmed exclusively with horses in Latah County.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. And so like, they didn't have the power to like till uphill, right? Yeah. Like roll the soil up and it would just like all pile up downhill more and more and more. Consequently, that's an awesome spot for our garden.
Yeah, because they leveled like it out.
Really deep, nice topsoil. Yeah. But
I've found some amazing things in soil pits where we're at sort of what's called the toe slope, you know, near the bottom of a hill, so the base of a hill. And we were digging a soil pit and we found a topsoil and then a subsoil and then another topsoil. So it was like a buried topsoil and that had a fence post in it.
Whoa.
So some pretty massive, and that was on a no-till field. It had been no-tilled since I think that field had been no-tilled at the time we sampled 25 years. So I don't know, since the 90s or something like that, that field had been no-tilled. And so it's just one thing about soils. Once you destroy it, it doesn't really build back very quickly. So
what is that no-till gaining a lot of traction then? Is that becoming more popular around here?
I mean, I would say it's probably leveled off. People are probably doing what they're going to do to some degree. I think, you know, it's really interesting and you should just have some farmers on if you really want to get the adoption history. But, you know, in the 90s, when it first came on, we didn't have everything worked out. So people did jump into it pretty hard. And some people went out of business because of that, because there was just different fertility concerns and diseases that happened in no-till. So some folks got really sort of, you had this issue where people didn't want to convert to no-till then, you know, because it's like, okay, well, you see that person go out of business or whatever. It can be kind of scary and it's expensive, because you have to change your equipment. Gotcha. So you can't just take the same seed drill that you're seeding in a conventional system. You've got to buy usually quite a bit more expensive, drill to switch over. That's probably changed a little bit. A lot of the early research in those days was, you know, how do you have a piece of equipment just drive into an untilled field and plant a seed where you know that seed is going to germinate? And that's actually, it might seem like a little question, but that there's like, if you go out to one of the old WSU farms, just like a whole bunch of old drills of all the iterations of people trying this. And yeah, soil physicists and mechanical engineers working on these things, trying to figure them out. And you know, people are still working on parts of that. We're always, you know, you're always just, farmers are some of the most innovative people I know, I would say. Like they're always
just tinkering,
tuning, yeah, trying to like get that system just maximized. And that's always, it's a fun group of people, community for me to work with as a soil scientist, to work with, especially the no-till, but all the growers that I've worked with, you know, because you might be tilling and then be really innovative in a different way. It's not like that's the only way you can be an innovator. So,
yeah, that's interesting. So is the equipment probably one of the biggest holdups to doing it? Or is there, or would you say like everybody should be no-till? Or is it like, well, for certain?
Yeah. So I'd hate to make everybody statements. I mean, you can't really do organic no-till here.
Okay.
Yeah. So you're going to have to use some herbicides. Right. And so it's like, okay, well, do you want to like, so if you're really, really pro organic and you don't want to use any herbicides, then you're going to have to do some tillage.
Gotcha.
You know, and so then you get into this kind of trade-off battle. It's like, am I going to do some tillage? And there's people that have experimented with organic no-till, but I've never seen that really, at least in this region, not a wide scale adoption. So like the Rodale Institute, back on the East Coast, they've invented some new equipment to do that, which is pretty cool stuff. But I don't really see it taking off and becoming like the way we farm on the Palouse. So yeah, I think
interesting.
Yeah. The capital input of that equipment is pretty big to start with. So just buying, you know, completely new equipment, it's expensive. It's not like these tractors and drills are cheap. And getting more expensive every day, probably.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, not to mention fuel and everything, fertilizer and everything else. It's going to be interesting.
Yeah, fuel is, and I'm going to get the numbers wrong, but fertilizer is, I know at least one grower who's basically seen it double.
Wow.
So coming to a grocery store near you something soon.
Yeah, no kidding.
Essentially. So that's really interesting. And so there's a lot of push right now is like, how do we reduce inputs? But that can have some issues too, you know, so you reduce inputs and then, you know, you might just be kicking a problem down the road. So say you go light on your herbicides this year. Well, you maybe miss some weeds and then those seeds are going to be in the, you know, in the ground for maybe the next 10, 20 years. So it's going to be like an entire career of fighting those plants. So short run, agriculture is one of those things where like short run decisions, it's like you have short run market conditions and you're trying to match it to sort of long-term sustainability needs. And that's a really difficult, two things to match up there.
Yeah. It's fascinating. Well, what you mentioned early on, traveling to other countries and stuff. Yeah. Is that something you're doing more of?
Yeah. So I don't know if you heard, but we're trying to move.
Yeah.
So
tell us about that.
Yeah. so we're, Lord willing, we'll be moving to Zambia in January.
Wow.
I went out there last fall and taught some.
And is that what you'll be doing then? Yes. Teaching?
Yes.
Okay.
So the sort of downside of the move is leaving extension and research behind, which have been really enjoyable parts of my job here. But it'll be nice to be focused just on teaching, because at WSU I was doing all three jobs, and that can it can just kind of pull you apart and you're like, where should I emphasize my time? So Zambia will be just teaching a tiny Christian college. And I went out last fall and dug some soil pits with some students and basically just kind of walked through and showed them what I knew about the soil. And then also did some online teaching for them. And it was really, really fun.
That's awesome.
Quite excited.
So the whole family going there, and yes. Is it you have a time frame on like how long you're planning to be there? Or
nothing's like written down. It's all kind of, here's what we're thinking is we're going to try and do 2 years and then see if we can keep going. I mean, we'd like to move and have that be our new home.
Wow.
But you never know with a move like that.
What's it? Is it, are they growing similar crops down there? Totally different.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's a completely different thing. I think maybe it's most like the South as far as what I saw for crops. Like, so you've got some cotton, some tobacco, maize, a lot of corn.
Is agriculture a pretty big part of their economy?
Yeah. So I think 70% of the population is involved in agriculture.
Wow.
But it's a lot different than our agriculture. So it's small scale subsistence. So that the biggest contributor to their economy is copper. So if you look at it, it's just like copper ore, but then they have a very agricultural community, and so a lot of people are like come from farms, you know, and so it's kind of interesting. Huh.
Well, that's exciting. We'll have to keep following that.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
We'll try and keep everybody in the loop. It should be fun. Maybe I'll start like a Zambia podcast.
You should. Yeah. Follow it. That's awesome.
Talk to farmers out there. But yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I know we've kind of barely scratched the surface on soils and everything else, but it's super interesting. I think that's one of the things I love about this area is all the agriculture, all the fields. And it's easy to even, I'd been here quite a while before it's like, I even bothered to find out what's growing over there. What is that? And how's that working? And the amount of kind of how big and sophisticated of a business it is too, is pretty amazing.
Yeah. And you can study soil for your entire life and never get bored. And there's several more lifetimes left in that. So if there's any kids out there like, I want to be a soil scientist, do it. It's a ton of fun. I really would not choose another field than what I'm doing. So I love this.
That's awesome. Well, thanks, Isaac. Yeah, appreciate you coming by, and best of luck in Zambia, especially.
Yeah. Thanks.
Thanks for joining us. Like, share, subscribe. We'll see you next week.